either this is a fire sale or you've had the same experience many of us have had of being educated by Ambassador Toon before on McNeil Air and other programs. We're delighted to have such a good turnout, and it is a great tribute to one of America's most distinguished diplomats. Is it now? See whether it is now, right. Malcolm Toon was ambassador to the Soviet Union from 1976 to 1979. He's been a foreign service, was a foreign service officer from 1946 to 1979. He held diplomatic appointments in a series of countries before being named ambassador to another series of countries. He was in Budapest and Moscow and Warsaw, Rome, Berlin. He thereafter became ambassador to Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia and Israel. In all those positions, he comported himself with great dignity and strength. So we feel uniquely privileged this morning to have an opportunity to hear him and talk with him on the Soviet Union and the world of change.
Well, thank you very much for that very warm and somewhat overly effusive introduction. I trust that when I've spoken my piece, the reaction of the audience will be as positive as I read your words to indicate you to be. But I must say, this hasn't always been the case. You know, not long ago I was on the West Coast for a speaking engagement. And I made what I thought was a very eloquent and persuasive presentation. And afterwards, this little old lady came up to the podium. And she said, "Mr. Ambassador, I thought your speech was simply superfluous." Now, while I was mulling over in my mind what this really meant, you know, whether this was a serious observation of what I'd said, or whether it was what we used to call in college English a malapropism. Remember that famous old gal in English literature who always got things wrong? She said, this little old lady said, "I do hope that a text of your remarks will be published." So I decided to put her in her place. I said, "Madam, the words of wisdom that I've uttered tonight, and which you have so warmly praised, will in fact be published. But because of the great seriousness and sensitivity of some of the observations that I've made, that text will be published posthumously." She said, "The sooner the better." So I hope that that reaction will not be echoed here today. Now, when I was invited to, well, perhaps that's not the proper way to put it, when my friend Bill Horbley commanded me to come to Charlottesville some months ago, I thought that I would spend most of my time talking about Europe, changes in the Soviet Union, the changes in Central and Eastern Europe, and so forth, because I'm alleged to have some expertise in that area. But then, of course, Saddam Hussein mucked things up. And so I decided that I should say a few words as well about the situation in the Gulf. Well, now, my wife, who has not always been one of my strongest supporters, has often reminded me that my credentials as an expert on the Middle East are somewhat less than impressive. In fact, as she has put it rather uncharitably, they are badly tarnished. And I remember when we were in Florida last year, I was asked by Eckerd College to speak on the Middle East. And my wife's reaction was, you're not going to do that, are you? Don't you remember what happened at the farewell lunch you had with Menachem Begin in Israel? Well, let me tell you that story. Begin was head of the opposition when I was ambassador in Israel. But we became very good friends. We didn't agree on anything. He didn't agree with anything I said or did. But we were good friends, primarily because we were honest with each other. Now, I became friends with him, and this is the stuff that history's made of, primarily because in those days I played a lot of tennis. And most of the tennis players in Israel are members of the Likud. So they brought me together with Begin for dinners, lunches, and so forth. So when the Soviets finally accepted me in Moscow as ambassador, Begin asked to have lunch with me down at the Knesset. And we had a good lunch. And then he asked to have a private word with me. And he drew me over to the window of the Knesset, which overlooks the West Bank, East Jerusalem. And he said, I know that you're going back to Washington. And I know that you'll be seeing the President and the Secretary of State. I want you to take a message back to them. Now, this is consistent with the relationship that you and I have had with each other. I haven't agreed with anything you said, but I've admired your honesty and your forthrightness. And in accordance with that spirit, I want you to take this message back. What's it like? I said, what's the message? Well, he said, I want you to tell the President that those lands out there that you call the West Bank, which I call Judea and Samaria, have always been Jewish, they're Jewish today, and they always will be Jewish. Well, I said, I don't think the President's going to embrace that message, but I'll pass it on to him. Now, I said, also consistent with this relationship that you and I have had, and which you very accurately described, straightforward, honest, let me give you some advice. Why don't you get out of politics? Because you don't have a chance. And 3 months later, he was elected prime minister. I went off to Moscow, and regularly, for the next 6 months, there would be an emissary, at least once a month, from Mr. Begin, not an Israeli, because there were very few Israelis in those days in Moscow, but usually a foreign diplomat with a message for Ambassador Toome. Tell the ambassador that I'm the prime minister of Israel today, and I intend to be the prime minister for years to come. Well, that's why Betty, my wife, says, I have no expertise in the Middle East. But I'll say a few words about the Gulf later on. But first, let's talk about Europe. Certainly, I think we can agree that 1989 was an incredible year in Central and Eastern Europe. And if anybody tells you that he could see the events coming that took place in Eastern Europe, in Central Europe, in 1989, he's lying in his teeth. Nobody saw them coming. Everybody was surprised. I used to say in Moscow when I was ambassador there, in my tables and publicly in speeches, that the system was so rotten, so inefficient, so inhumane, so uncivilized, that it could not survive. And ultimately, forces for change at work in Soviet society would bring about a basic change. But I was thinking of 30 or 40 years down the road, not 5 or 6 years or 10 years that so happened. But in 1989, the map of Eastern Europe was completely changed. Six nations emerged, shaking off the Moscow control and striving for independence, pluralism in some cases, a market economy, and democracy. Look what happened in Poland. The year began with Solidarity, the trade union movement, outlawed. And now Solidarity is running the government. In Hungary, you had the Communist Party almost totally discredited, and you have forces at work now working toward a market economy and a political pluralism. In Romania, of course, you had the terrible dictator Ceausescu apprehended and summarily executed, together with his awful wife. And now they're trying to sort things out, regrettably, with still a great deal of pain. Even in Bulgaria, where, as we used to say, Jack, you know this story very well, of course, when it rained in Moscow, the Bulgarians would put up their umbrellas. But even there, and this was demonstrated several weeks ago when angry crowds sacked Communist Party headquarters and burned it. Even there, they're moving towards something that is vastly different from the society they had. And then finally, of course, you've got East Germany, now part of a reunited Germany. Now, how did all this happen, this incredible chain of events in Central Eastern Europe? Well, there are some people, mostly in Washington, who say that it was because of the steadiness of purpose in the Western world, particularly in the United States, our strong military posture that brought this about. Now, that comes very close to being arrant nonsense. Now, don't misunderstand me. I feel strongly that we should have consistent political goals, and we should have strong military underpinning in order to make sure that our policies are credible. But that is not what caused the change in Central and Eastern Europe. It was Gorbachev. For the first time since 1945, Gorbachev released Central and Eastern Europe from Moscow's control, made it clear that under no conditions would Soviet force be used. And that's why it was possible for the various governments in Central and Eastern Europe to respond to the public demand for change, because they had no other choice. They knew that Moscow would not be behind them. Now, why did this happen? Well, it is not, as some people say, because Gorbachev turned out to be a great humanitarian overnight, or that he's devoted to political pluralism. He's neither, and probably never will be. It is simply because Gorbachev, because of the tremendous mess that his country is in right now, economic mess primarily, had no choice. He knew that if he repeated the experience of 1956 in Hungary, 1968 in Czechoslovakia, he would lose the support of the intelligentsia inside the Soviet Union, whose support he must have if there's any chance at all of perestroika succeeding, and the chances, I think, are very slim, by the way. And secondly, and more importantly, he needed the financial and material help of the Western European countries. And he knew that if he invaded or encouraged the various governments in Central Europe to put down the uprisings with force, that he would not get any help at all from Western Europe. Western Europe would simply be alienated. That's why it happened in Central Europe. And I think we ought to be clear about that. Well, now, what about Gorbachev himself? Is he going to survive? I don't know. Washington doesn't know. And Gorbachev himself probably doesn't know. I think all we know is that he faces tremendous opposition inside Soviet society, coming from a number of quarters. First of all, the bureaucrats and party hacks that he's kicked out and who are now suffering because they no longer have the perks that they have under previous Soviet party leaders. Now, secondly, certain elements within the KGB and the military who are very unhappy about glasnost and its effect on their ability to control the population and keep the country more or less intact, which they regard as their principal objective. And finally, I think, and most importantly, opposition from the blue-collar worker, who has really suffered under Gorbachev. He's worse off today than he was 5 years ago when Gorbachev came to power. Now here, let me tell you a Soviet joke. Now this is not quite so whimsical an approach and irresponsible approach as it may seem at first blush, because those of you who know the Soviet Union know that all Soviet jokes have deep political content. And this joke, I think, very graphically illustrates the problem that Gorbachev faces today. The joke is about a simple Russian worker. And I plumbed the depths of my imagination and come up with a very ingenious name, Ivan Ivanovich. Ivan Ivanovich is heading for work one morning. And as he leaves the tiny little scruffy apartment that he has, which is a lot of every blue-collar worker in the Soviet Union, his wife said, "Honey, on your way home, stop at the gastronome and get some meat." So he heads for his factory. He toils at the lathe all day. Then the whistle blows, and he heads for home. Goes to the gastronome, he waits an hour and a half to get in. Then he gets inside the gastronome, waits another hour and a half to get to the meat counter. Gets to the meat counter, asks for some beef, no beef. "You have any pork?" "No pork." "You have any lamb?" "No lamb." "Well, do you have a piece of poultry? A chicken or a turkey or something?" "No, no poultry." Then he blows a stack. He said, "My God," the top of his voice, in this crowded gastronome. He said, "My God, they call this the workers' paradise. You can't even get a piece of meat. We ought to toss out the rascals and start all over again." Then he leaves the gastronome. He walks down about three blocks. Three plainclothesmen, KGB plainclothesmen, come up from behind him, grab him, throw him up against the wall. And they said, "Comrade, we heard what you said back there in the gastronome. We're going to be watching you very carefully from now on. Do you know what would have happened to you 20 years ago? If you'd said then what you said today, you would have been shot." And they let him go. And he gets back to his little apartment, and his wife yells, "Honey, did you bring meat?" "Meat, for God's sake, they've even run out of ammunition." Well, that shows you the nature of the problem that Gorbachev faces. Well, now he's made some sort of murky arrangement with Yeltsin, who, as you know, now heads up the Russian Republic, and feels strongly that Gorbachev has not gone far enough, fast enough. At least that's what he says. This so-called 500-day arrangement. Now, I hope it works, because I don't wish the Russian people ill. Anything that improves their lot in life, I think all of us favor. I couldn't care less about Gorbachev, but I do care about the Russian people. And if, in fact, this brings about progress toward a market economy, I think we all should be reasonably happy about it. But I don't think that we ought to do anything to help Gorbachev. I think the mess that he's in is his own fault. That is the fault of the system, and he was a basic part of the system his whole adult life. I think sometimes, you know, people seem to forget, those that embrace Gorbachev as a good friend, as Reagan did, and engage in chumminess, as frankly, regrettably, Mr. Bush is too, seem to forget that his two mentors, when he was young in the party, were two of the worst rapscallions in recent Soviet political history. One was Suslov, who was the chief ideologue for years in the Politburo, who was the architect of the whole policy of enslavement of Eastern Europe, who was the architect also of the policy of crushing the dissent movement inside the Soviet Union itself. And the other was Andropov, who spent, as you know, most of his adult years arresting and killing people as head of the KGB. These were Gorbachev's mentors. Now, it seems to me that some of the brutality, some of the ideological fervor, some of the toughness must have rubbed off on this guy from these two people. So I think we ought to be very careful about identifying ourselves personally with Gorbachev. Certainly, as I said before, we wish him well in the sense that we hope that he will behave in such a way as to make the world a safer place and also improve the standard of living of the average Russian. But we'll have to see. Now, just a word about the Gulf. You know, it used to be Europe that was fraught with peril, danger, threats, and so forth, until Saddam Hussein came along. He changed all that. Europe is relatively calm now, and probably will be for years to come, except for some problems within Eastern Europe. But basically the threat is gone. There's no question about that. The threat is now in the Middle East. And we are on the brink of a tremendous explosion in that part of the world. Now, I think to Bush's credit, he has been extraordinarily successful so far in mustering international support for our move into the Middle East, our military move. But I think the real crises lie ahead, primarily because it's a question, at least in my mind, whether we have the staying power to handle a problem for as long as Saddam Hussein is around. There are some who say, well, he'll be assassinated one of these days, he'll be overthrown, or he'll resign voluntarily. Well, I don't think any one of these things is going to happen. So we're going to have to be out there for a long time. Now, traditionally, we have not had the sort of staying power which is necessary to handle this sort of problem over the long term. And the second thing that we have to worry about, and this is more important, is the fact that as each day goes by, Saddam's campaign to demonstrate within the Arab world, to demonstrate that this is not Iraq against the entire world, which is the case, of course, but it's Iraq against the United States, aided and abetted by Israel. Now, if that sort of point of view gets across in the Arab world, and regrettably, this was given a big boost in the last few days by the events on the Temple Mount, or the Dome of the Rock, as Islam calls it. So that's a problem that we're going to face. Now, my own feeling is, and I'll just wind up on this note, is that we ought to move, and move now, to internationalize, particularly the military forces in the region. They should be under the aegis of the United Nations. And under no conditions should we take independent, unilateral military action against Saddam Hussein. If that happens, we're finished in the Arab world. And I think we ought to recognize that. Now, just one final note. I think on this point, Bush, don't misunderstand me, I have great respect for George Bush. And I think, frankly, we're well off. We're very lucky indeed to have finally, after 14 years, 12 years, a man in the White House who has good foreign policy credentials and who's well equipped to deal with foreign policy problems and above all to deal with the Soviet threat, the Soviet Union. But I think he made two tactical mistakes in Helsinki when he last met with Gorbachev. When Gorbachev said, under no conditions will Soviet forces be permitted to perform in the Middle East except under UN aegis, Bush said, fine, we go along with that. You work it out in the United Nations, and we'll back you to the hill. But he didn't. And the second mistake I think he made was not insisting that Gorbachev withdraw all those technical advisors from Iraq, who were there, of course, training the Iraqis to kill us. Now, he claims that they have contractual obligations. Well, I never knew any Soviet official that was worried about contractual obligations. But in any case, I think those two tactical mistakes were made. But we do face very serious problems ahead of us. But there is one very interesting result of the changes in Central Europe and the changes in the Soviet Union over the past 2 years. And that is that it has enabled us to move the way we have in the Persian Gulf. In the past, you know, we've always worried about the Soviet reaction to our move into regional disputes, triggering possibly a military reaction and even nuclear war. Now that's gone. We can move into any regional dispute and not worry about a Soviet reaction. In fact, we can do it, as we demonstrated in the Security Council recently, with massive international support, and probably with the help of the Soviet Union. That's a basic change on the world scene. Well, I think I'll stop there and then open up for discussion. Thank you.
Who'd like to ask the first question? Henry Theobald.
With the infrastructure in Russia, uranium, the shape it's in, is it credible to think that they're going to be able to get a structure in place, an economic structure in place, to make even any material headway even in the 500 days? The thing that bothers me is you can't put together something from nothing in a short period of time, and this needs people, it needs training, and money, and all are in short supply, and it's it would appear to me that we have some sort of a vacuum there that will be filled by something.
Do I ever repeat the question?
If you would, they can't hear it out there.
Well, the question relates to the internal economic problems in the Soviet Union. And the questioner suggested that it's highly unlikely that even within the 500-day period that I mentioned, that they're going to be able to move toward the sort of economy which will result in the sorts of things that Gorbachev wants, primarily because there's a tremendous vacuum there, and the question really is, you know, what's going to happen? Well, I tend to share your pessimism. I don't think... first of all, you know, I think we ought to recognize that the Soviet people are a highly talented people. There's no question about that. And the Soviet Union has more resources, natural resources, than any other country in the world. It's the system that's been so lousy. Now, regrettably, they've had that system for over 70 years. And it has bred all kinds of bad habits inside Soviet society, to the point where the sort of thing that you're talking about, the sort of thing apparently that Gorbachev hopes for, probably isn't going to work. Now, as I said before, I don't think that should be of great concern to us Americans. As I said before, this is Gorbachev's problem. He's got to work it out himself. Now, as far as Western Europe, Central Europe is concerned, and Eastern Europe, I think they do deserve our help, because they were victims of the Soviet system. But my own feeling is that we ought to leave this up to our Western European friends. They know the area better than we do. They're better off than we are at the present time. I mean, let's face it, we're broke in this country. You know, we have a massive budget deficit, an incredible trade imbalance. And we have terrible internal problems in this country that are crying out for help, such as advancing social decay, you might call it, homelessness, and the drug problem included in this. We have a terribly inferior educational system, below the college level. I think we're all right at the college level and above. And then finally, we have a crumbling infrastructure, you know, with our roads and bridges and even industry, sadly in need of repair, if not complete replacement. Now, those problems we've got to take care of with this country if we are not going to go into the 21st century as the sort of thing that Gorbachev fears for the Soviet Union as a third-rate power. So I don't think we ought to think about helping the Soviet Union at all. But my own feeling is that you're probably right, it's not going to work.
Next question. Yes, Mrs. Murphy.
I can shout, so maybe you won't have to repeat my questions. I have read some things lately that greatly disturb me. And just as this, that the architects of our foreign policy, whomever they may be, now that the Soviet Union is no longer a threat, our foreign policy cannot be geared and directed to stopping the advances of the Soviet Union wherever they may be in any part of the world. So now they're thinking that we should be a policeman to the world. We want to be a number one nation, and we don't seem to have much chance of being number one economically when the Japanese and the Germans are outdoing us more and more. So therefore, our role will be the policeman of the world, because we are the most well-armed. We have the most military might. And that's going to send us into every little disturbance in every little third world country. And I think that's a very dangerous policy. And maybe it's begun by the policy of going into Saudi Arabia. Now, maybe the proof will be that we will only work under United Nations direction and not do anything unilaterally, and then that'll be all right. But what do you think of all that?
Well, I agree with, and I think this was obvious from my own remarks earlier, I agree with everything you said. I don't think we should have to do everything alone. I think, frankly, the military effort in the Middle East was too massive. I think we've got to start working through the United Nations. And the United Nations is a different organization today because of the changed attitude of the Soviet Union. You have a real opportunity, it seems to me, of working out a decent security force, which then could be used to police the world in these tiny little regional conflicts. I don't think it should be up to us. Now, beyond that, I think some of the wealthy allies and friends ought to be picking up more of the tab than they're picking up. The Germans, tremendously wealthy. And it's true the Germans say, well, we've got East Germany to take care of, but they can do a little bit more than they've done so far. So that I think if we persuade our wealthier friends to pick up more of the burden than they have so far, and if we use the United Nations more effectively in the future, because of the changed world condition, then I think probably we will not have to play the role of policemen. I don't think we can afford it anymore.
Next question. Yes, Dr. Fishman.
Well, in view of our inability to help Eastern Europe financially, do you think a new Peace Corps would be in order? And could it be put across?
Do you hear the question?
No.
What about a new Peace Corps? For Eastern Europe?
Well, if you're talking about the sort of Peace Corps that we had in the past, that we have now, no, that's not what they need. What they need is technical advice and help. Now, if you could develop a Peace Corps drawn from American industry, or West German industry, yes, I think that's the sort of thing we ought to do. And they need that sort of help now, and urgently. And I think that's the sort of thing that American industry and Western European industry ought to be doing.
Jack Armitage.
Matt, can you comment, this old area stomping ground of yours, can you comment on Poland's chances of making it
Can you comment on Poland's chances of making it?
Well, you know, I've got a great deal of affection for the Poles because this happened to be my first diplomatic post. Well, let me tell you about that, and then I'll get to your question, Jack. You know, I came out of the Navy after 5 years in the Navy, 3 years in combat as a PT boat skipper, to enter the posh diplomatic service. My first post was Warsaw, which was 95% destroyed. As you know, the Germans blew it up systematically as they left. And with combat in the streets. So I came out of combat in the Pacific into combat at Warsaw. Well, Warsaw in those days, as I think most East European missions were, was manned by traditional foreign service officers. People who felt that a third secretary and vice consul, as I was at that point, having been a lieutenant commander in the Navy, I come in as a third secretary and vice consul. But most people in those days felt that a third secretary and vice consul should walk the ambassador's dog and nothing else. And never forget my first meeting with the ambassador, with Arthur Bliss Lane. We were all living in the Hotel Polonium, and he invited the new officers down for a drink to his quarters. And he sat next to me, and I never saw a man swill so many Manhattans in half an hour as he did. But then he turned to me and he said, first place, a man that drinks Manhattans, it doesn't deserve any sort of appreciation. But he turned to me and he said, young man, what do you think of things here? And I thought he was asking me for my opinion of our policy toward Eastern Europe, which I thought was totally misguided. I went on at great length and eloquently, I thought, trying to demonstrate my point of view that, you know, we were wrong to be working with the pre-war groups. We got to start working with the new groups that are emerging in Eastern European society if we're going to, you know, combat the communist menace. And at the end of this very eloquent presentation, Ambassador Lane said, young man, how long have you been in the Foreign Service? And I said, about 5 weeks. He said, how long have you been in Warsaw? I said, about a week. Well, he said, that, in some people's view, may excuse your behavior, but I don't think it does. You are in the Foreign Service now, and you are to listen to your seniors. You were never, never to express your point of view. You listened quietly and attentively. See, I went back to my room that night, a crummy little room in the Hotel Polonia. I said, I'm not sure that I'm in the right service. And I stuck it out. In any case, we did gain a great deal of affection for the Poles. You know, they would crawl out of the ruins every morning, 400,000 or 500,000 of them, go to work, do their job, so forth. And then, of course, ultimately, they were taken over by the communists and they led a miserable life for the next 40 years. I hope they'll make it, Jack. I'm a little bit disappointed that Solidarnosc is splitting up and Wałęsa's turning out to be a little bit too big for his britches. And the struggle that's going on between Wałęsa and Mazowiecki right now, I think, is not good for Poland. But I think because of the terrific spirit of independence on the part of the Poles, their desire to make their country a going thing, with considerable help from Western Europe primarily, I think they could probably make it, but it's not going to be easy.
Next question. Colonel Foote.
First, an observation. I think it's highly interesting to see the here are two senior diplomats facing each other at the table, and both of them came out of the Navy. too.
Well,
I can appreciate your feeling, Mr. Ambassador, the lieutenant commander, you've got a hell of a lot more authority than in whatever your word FSO6
does.
Eight. Real question is, would you say a word about the influence or the future of this Boris Yeltsin, who's currently Gorbachev's chief adversary, and what is the significance and importance of this increasing autonomy of the independent Soviet republics?
What about the future of Boris Yeltsin, and what about the increasing autonomy of the 15 Soviet Socialist Republics?
Well, as far as Yeltsin's concerned, first place, I don't know the guy. I never even heard of him until he suddenly appeared as a luminary on the Soviet scene. As a matter of fact, I never even met Gorbachev until last year when he came to Washington and I was invited up there as a former ambassador to shake his hand. And that's because, this may sound supercilious, but that's because Gorbachev was too junior for me as the American ambassador to know. He was not a member of the Politburo when I was there. He wasn't even in Moscow until my last year in Moscow. So I don't know Yeltsin, but I have the feeling that so far it's just been a lot of noise. He hasn't done anything for anybody. So I'm not at all sure that he's going to be a much help to Gorbachev, or vice versa. Now, you raised a very important question, which I should have touched on in my remarks, and that is the surge of nationalism inside the Soviet Union. I think there's no question about it. Lithuania and the other Baltic states are going to ultimately be independent. No question about that. But meanwhile, Gorbachev is facing very serious problems in Georgia, in Armenia, in Central Asia, and most importantly, in the Ukraine. And one of these days, I think later, probably sooner, these countries are going to break off from the Soviet Union. Now, I couldn't care less about that. I've always felt that a breakup of the Soviet Empire would be, frankly, in our interest in the long term. But I do care about the fact that the world situation, if this sort of thing happens, might become much more dangerous because of nuclear weapons. These are, no matter what Moscow has said recently, these are scattered across the Soviet Union, together with very effective delivery systems. Now, if those fall into the hands of some irresponsible type, such as you have in Central Asia, then I think we're in for a very dangerous period. So I think, at least in this respect, in this limited respect, we ought to be willing to work with the Soviet authorities to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen. Now, you did have recently a statement by one of the top Soviet generals saying that they'd move these weapons. Then you have a denial out of Moscow the next day, saying that this is not the case. But that, to me, is the real danger. It's not the fact that the Soviet Union will break up. I think, as I indicated, that would be in the long range in our favor, for our advantage.
George Barrow.
It was announced this morning that Gorbachev has won the Nobel Peace Prize. Would you care to comment on that?
Just say no comment.
For what? What peace are we talking about? I suppose it's Central Europe. Is that the reason for it?
They did say, he said it just came on the news that he won the Nobel Peace Prize
in Westbrook.
Well, you know, Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize and he accepted it. The Duke Toll, who died just yesterday, refused it because peace had not been achieved in his view. I think Gorbachev ought to take the same view. He ought to turn it down because we don't have peace in the world today. We have very important changes in Central and Eastern Europe. We have changes going on inside the Soviet Union, but the world is still a very dangerous place. I think primarily because of past Soviet bad behavior. So why do you give him the Peace Prize? I think, frankly, they ought to scrap that Nobel Committee. Some of the things they've been doing recently are just totally irresponsible. But he needs the money, and I guess that...
Victor Yonke.
Mr. Ambassador, I don't quarrel with your statement, but the UN should take charge or some direction in the Middle East, which I assume would mean militarily, too. But you have a quantity in there of the Saudis having a substantial say. You might end up with the United States, the Saudis, and the UN all having divergent opinions of what should be done. How can you organize that and keep it cohesive?
What about the divergent opinions in the UN, if the UN is to be the policeman?
No, I don't say that this can be done tomorrow, the day after tomorrow. All I'm saying is that we cannot afford to be, the as this lady pointed out earlier, the world's policeman. And you do have a changed United Nations today, primarily because of the change in the Soviet attitude. And I think we ought to take advantage of that and try over the long run to develop, you know, together with clear-thinking friends, a United Nations which is capable of doing the sorts of things which it was set up to do originally. I don't know whether they can do it or not, but I think we have to make the effort. But my own feeling strongly held is that if we remain the principal military force in the Arab world, we're not going to have any friends left in the Arab world. So what do you gain by this?
Next question.
I'd like to ask a question from the ambassador. Every day you read, Ambassador, that American companies are being asked to invest in the Soviet Union. Is this a good investment for an American company or not?
Every day you hear American companies are being asked to invest in the Soviet Union. Is this a good investment for American companies or not?
Well, if I were the CEO of an American company, I'd be very careful about that sort of thing. I think there are some opportunities for reasonably profitable joint ventures because the rules have been changed over the past 6 months. But I'd be very, very careful about how I proceeded in that direction until Gorbachev manages to clean up the Soviet mess. Well, I don't see that happening for a long time.
Thank you very much.
Next question. You were the member of a number of delegations to disarmament conferences. Where do we stand in our arms control negotiations, and where ought we to be trying to go?
Well, I think we're pretty close to agreement on strategic arms. There are still some details to be worked out. And apparently we've just about reached agreement on conventional forces in Europe. So I think we're in reasonably good shape. I think what we ought to do next is work on the testing program. I think, frankly, you cannot expect countries to join the non-proliferation agreement and not go nuclear, you know, so long as we're testing nuclear weapons. Now, there's a great deal of dispute about this in the scientific community in this country, about whether we need testing. Well, I tend to agree with those scientists who say we don't need it, so let's stop it. But we're the ones that have dragged our feet on extending the test ban, making it comprehensive. The Soviets have been willing to do this. Now, whether they're willing to do it when it comes down to the crunch, here's another point. I'm not sure about that. But I think we ought to put them to the test. Well, I think that should be our next step. Primarily because there is very little chance, it seems to me, and it's totally unreasonable for us to expect all nations to subscribe to the Non-Proliferation Agreement, so long as we're continuing to maintain huge nuclear arsenals far beyond our needs, and continue to test nuclear weapons and develop even more horrible weapons as time goes by.
Next, Next question. Any questions in the outer reaches?
Another one here.
Wilson Newman.
That's down past. If not a possibility. That being the case, and the significance for the future of the United States, of the status of Russia in the future, number one, have we explored and are we developing national plans for the possible alternatives? And two, if so, what are those alternatives and what is your opinion concerning?
Is that all?
He's got it.
In diplomatic proceedings, I reserve the right to follow up.
I'm afraid of that. Well, on the first, I did not indicate that glasnost was about to go down the drain. I think glasnost is here to stay. You know, the genie's out of the bottle. And you can't, that I think that's irreversible in Soviet society. Soviet people are used to that now, and they like it, and they're not going to permit a return to the old system, you know, where they're getting a pack of lies on television and over the radio and in the press and so forth. That's changed. I did indicate that perestroika, which is restructuring, realigning the Soviet economy, is not at all sure of succeeding. I think, frankly, you've got to have much more willingness on the part of the Soviet public to make the basic changes that are required if, in fact, you're going to wind up with something close to a market economy. You know, I like the story about the Soviet farmer who's out plowing his field, and the plow runs into a bottle, and out of the bottle comes a genie, and the genie is so happy that he's been rescued by this poor Soviet farmer. He says, "If you have a wish, I'll grant it to you. What would you like?" Well, he said, "My neighbor over there has his own cow." "Oh, what, would you like your own cow?" "No, I want that cow killed." that is reflective of the average attitude of the Soviet citizen, the attitude of the average Soviet citizen, the blue-collar worker. He's scared to death of change. He's been used to a paternalistic system of government that has handled everything for him, and he just is not up to the task of you know, thinking for himself. Now, that's the fundamental problem that Gorbachev faces, and it seems to me it's going to be a long time before there's any change in that, and that's why I think perestroika has very little chance of succeeding in the near term. That answer all your questions.
Any follow-up? Next.
So did you ask?
As a matter of fact, I wondered if that was all of your answer. My question had to do with assuming that eventuality that perestroika does collapse. Collapse to what? Return? Is there a dictatorship? The disintegration of the empire? Renewal of communism? What are the alternatives? Would you rank them?
Well, I knew that you would ask that question. I deliberately refused to answer because I don't know the answer to that. I think there's no question about it, the Soviet Union is going to disintegrate, at least in part. And I think probably you'll wind up ultimately with a Russia and Belarusia combining to be the Soviet Union of the future. The rest will be independent, sovereign in various degrees, it seems to be. Now, whether there will be a military takeover, I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. I don't think you can revert to the old system, because it's been demonstrated by all kinds of people and by events themselves that it's totally inefficient. So I think you're going to have to wind up with some sort of blend of a market economy and a paternalistic, socialistic society. But what the ultimate format will be, I have no idea. Nor does Gorbachev, and he's on the scene. If he doesn't have any idea, how can I be expected to have any idea?
Other questions, Colonel Flint?
Somebody out there want to
Dan Matter.
If you could comment at all on the situation as you see it in Yugoslavia.
Yugoslavia. Well, let me... Do I have time to tell another story?
Sure.
Well, I entered on my mission in Yugoslavia under the best possible circumstances. My first official function was to take Tito around his country on his first state visit. Well, that's the way for an ambassador to start off. And I remember very well flying across the country from Houston to Long Beach in a White House aircraft. And Tito asked me up into his quarters to have a private conversation. We spoke Russian. He speaks fluent Russian. Very funny, you know. He was a sergeant in the Austro-Hungarian Imperial Army, captured by the Russians, taken to Moscow, POW, married a Russian gal, learned the Russian language, became a communist. Well, at the end of this conversation, he said, you know, Mr. Ambassador, you speak very good Russian. But he said, now you're the ambassador in my country. You learn my language. Well, I had no intention of learning Serbo-Croatian. It's an impossible language. And it's close enough to Russian so that if you start working on Serbo-Croatian, you're going to ruin your Russian, which I thought was a reasonably important language. Well, I get back to Belgrade, and I call my staff together. And I said, I've got to learn this damn language. I told them a story. So get me a teacher. So I started taking lessons. But a week after I got back, I was called to the Foreign Office to have a long talk, sort of review of Tito's trip to the States, with Tepovac, who was then the foreign minister. He'd been on the trip, but he was not privy to the conversation I had with Tito. And he said, you know, Mr. Ambassador, you have a leg up on every other ambassador in town. You know the two great world languages fluently, English and Russian. There's no point in your fooling around with our language. And I told him the story. And he cleared his throat and said, well, maybe it would be a good idea. The point of the story is that this old man had tremendous power. He was the only true Yugoslav. And you've got to understand that Yugoslavia is a very complex little country. You know, the Slovenians hate the Croatians. Croatians hate the Serbs. The Serbs hate the Montenegrins. The Montenegrins hate the Macedonians. And they all hate the Albanians in the Kosovo. And it was my feeling when I left Yugoslavia that unless they could continue to submerge these highly emotional feelings that they have in Yugoslavia, they were going to go down the drain. And that would open up an opportunity for the Soviets, not now under Gorbachev, but under the old regime, to come back in and correct the mistake that Stalin had made years previously by letting Tito go unpunished. Well, they are falling apart. And my own feeling is that that you will have Slovenia and Croatia, which are the two wealthiest republics in Yugoslavia, and republics that are tired of picking up the tab for the lazy, inefficient, ignorant people in the south, as they think they are, the Macedonians, Montenegrins, and the Kosovans, the Albanians. And I think then you will have other republics peeling off, too. So I don't, unless there's a military takeover, which is a possibility in Yugoslavia, I don't see any prospect at all of Yugoslavia remaining the sort of country that I knew when I was there. And I'm unhappy about that, but that's the way it's going.
The one country, Mr. Ambassador, where you've served as ambassador on which you haven't commented is Czechoslovakia.
Well, I think they're doing very well under Václav Havel and Dubček. Incidentally, I didn't meet either one when I was ambassador in Prague because they were both in prison all the time when I was there. But I think Czechoslovakia, you must understand that Czechoslovakia is the only country in Eastern Europe, Central Europe, with a democratic tradition and also a tradition of a capitalist, free capitalist economy. It was a shining little example of a capitalist state between the two worlds. So they have something to build on, and I think Havel is doing that slowly, but I think surely. So they have an advantage over all the other countries in Central and Eastern Europe. So I think they'll probably make out all right. I think they have the best chance of anybody, primarily because of their tradition.
We ought to give Bill Harbley the chance to ask the last question. He's responsible for this program today, with a little assistance from the ambassador.
Actually, this is changing the subject a bit. The Miller Center's been involved in studying the presidencies. We had an interesting conversation of the ambassador having met with Jimmy Carter. I don't know whether he wants to repeat it or not, but it was very interesting.
Well, let me tell you about my appointment to Moscow. I was appointed by Gerry Ford in September of 1976 when I was ambassador in Israel. The Soviets don't like me. I don't like them. I think that's a pretty good relationship between the American ambassador and the Soviet regime, any Soviet regime. But in any case, they sat on what we call the agrément, which is the technical term for agreeing to an ambassadorial appointment, for almost 3 months. Now, that was unprecedented. Ford had lost the election, and the Soviets were hoping that Jimmy Carter would relieve them of the obligation of accepting me as ambassador. Well, I sat in Israel for these 3 months. You know, I don't know how many of you know the Israeli press. Totally independent, as ours is, and totally irresponsible, as ours isn't, for the most part. So the Israeli press, almost every day, would say, Ambassador Toon's never going to go to Moscow. Soviets will never receive him, and we're stuck with him for a long time to come. And I got a little bit tired of this sort of commentary every day in the press. So finally, I sent a telegram to Henry Kissinger. And in the telegram, I said, now, please don't misunderstand the purport of this message. It has nothing to do with me personally. I've had a good career. I've had more posts than I deserve, perhaps. But the point is this, that you ought to do something about the Soviets' refusal to accept me as ambassador. This is an insult to the president. The president has picked me as ambassador, and they refuse to accept me. I suggest that you call in Ambassador Dobrynin, who was then in his 24th year as ambassador in Washington. That's real continuity for you. I call in Ambassador Dobryna and tell him that unless his government accepts Toom within 48 hours, you, Ambassador Dobryna, will pack your bags and go home, and we'll get along without ambassadors. Well, within 48 hours, I get a call from Washington saying, come on back, the Soviets have accepted you. I go back to Washington, and a young officer meets me at Dulles Airport. The secretary wants to see you right away. I go into Kissinger's office, and I said, what happened? He said, we followed your advice. Now, the interesting part of this story is that the Soviets, who, as I say, hated me, were prepared to pay the price of having me come to Moscow as ambassador in order to keep Dobryna in Washington. Now, then as I said, Carter came into office. Now, I went to Moscow on the basis of an interim appointment. You have that when the Senate is out of session. Now, under the rules of interim appointments, you have to resubmit the appointment to the reconvened Senate within 5 days for the appointment lapses. So there were 56 interim appointees under Ford whose names were about to be submitted to the reconvened Senate after Carter was inaugurated. Most of them were purely domestic political appointees, and they should have gone down the drain. But there were four ambassadors. Now, the White House decided that those appointments should be canceled. So they sent word up to the Senate to cancel. Well, the word went out all over the world. Carter cancels Toom's appointment. And I got all these messages from friends in Moscow saying, gee, we're sorry to see you go. We're just getting used to working with you and look forward to a good relationship. And wait a minute, I'm not going anywhere. This is a technicality, I think. And it was a technicality at that point, except that there were people around Mr. Carter who wanted me replaced because I was known as a hardliner, and some of my friends, in quotes, such as Governor Harriman and others, were pressing Mr. Carter to send a prominent American businessman to Moscow in order to convey a positive signal to the Brezhnev leadership. So I was in limbo for 3 or 4 months. I was the ambassador and functioned as the ambassador, but I had very little contact with Washington. I'd never met Mr. Carter. In fact, like most Americans, I didn't even know who he was when he became president. And meanwhile, word was coming out of Washington that Washington was cooking up all kinds of arms control proposals to present to the Soviets. I sent a message to Vance, an old friend of mine, who said, I think I ought to come back and give you the Soviet slant on this sort of thing. And he sent a message back saying, I don't think this is a good time for you to come back to Washington because it would be embarrassing because the president hasn't made up his mind yet. Well, finally he did make up his mind and kept me on. And I discovered later from Jody Powell that the only reason he did this was because he was told by Jody Powell and others who were working with the press that if he fired me from Moscow, he would be accused of being soft in the communists. So he kept me on. So I go back to Washington to meet Mr. Carter for the first time, as well as other members of his cabinet. I spent 45 minutes with Mr. Carter, alone in the Oval Office. He starts out the conversation by saying, Mac, good to see you. Well, I never even met the guy before. Then he went on to say, you don't know this, but as a matter of fact, you don't know all the letters that I've sent to Mr. Brezhnev. You've seen some of them, but you haven't seen all of them. Well, that came as a big blow to me, as the ambassador from Moscow, not knowing what the president was saying to Brezhnev. But he said, beyond that, you know, I've written all those letters in longhand. And I said, well, in order to convey to Mr. Brezhnev the way I feel about this relationship. And I said, you know, Mr. President, with all respect, you know, your letters in longhand never reach Brezhnev's desk. He doesn't know that you're writing them in longhand. As a matter of fact, you know, by the time they reach Brezhnev, they've been staffed up by all these hard-headed types in the KGB and the Foreign Office and so forth, just as happens back here with his letters to you. And the answers on top and so forth. So, well, he said that may be, but you know, I can detect from his letters to me a strong personal bond between us. I think we're both pursuing basically the same political objectives. Well, by this time, you know, I'm climbing the wall. You know, talking this way about a guy whose hands are dripping with blood, you know, Brezhnev is a crummy type. And finally wound up the conversation. And I went down the hall to see my old friend, Brzezinski, whom I'd been at Harvard with a number of years before. And I said, Spig, boy, you got a big job on your hands. You got to go into that office and tell this man the facts of political life. Well, then I, don't misunderstand me, Carter is a very decent human being. And I think, frankly, he's turned out to be a very good and effective and worthwhile former president, unlike others that we see playing the golf courses and rushing off to Moscow and Japan at huge tabs and so forth. Carter, at least, has not made a cent since he's left the White House. And he's done a lot, I think, for humanity since then. But he was not a very good president. And finally, toward the end of 1979, I decided that I wasn't getting through to him. I'd had almost 3 years in Moscow, total of almost 8 years, enough. 35 years in the Foreign Service, enough. But beyond that, there was a very practical reason that my wife was getting tired of being the nation's innkeeper abroad, and she wanted to go home. So I submitted my resignation. But it was primarily because I was not getting through to Mr. Carter. So it's difficult at times, you know, for an ambassador to who has respect for the president, as I did for Carter, but to realize that, you know, I was simply not getting through. The first official job that I was given under Mr. Carter was to deliver, personally, my instructions were, a letter to Sakharov. Well, Sakharov had been labeled publicly by the Soviet government as public enemy number one. And it was perfectly clear from all my conversations that, you know, I couldn't really deal with Sakharov, except indirectly, you know, through members of my staff. Now, here I get this instruction. And I knew that if I did this, you know, I'd be finished as the American ambassador in Moscow. I sent a message, I called my staff together. I said, look, this is stupid. You know, for the new administration behaved this way. They claim they want a good working relationship with the Brezhnev administration. This is precisely the wrong way to go about it. There are other ways of getting word to Sakharov that the president feels deeply about his situation and so forth. So I said, let's send a message back. And so we did. I get a message back from Brzezinski. Back channel. And we've considered all these angles. Go ahead with your instructions. Meanwhile, Vance was out in the Middle East, and I didn't think he knew about this, so I sent a personal message to him. And do you know what I've been asked to do? 2 days go by, Obviously, Vance had not been informed. And finally, I got a personal message from Vance saying, I think you better do it. Well, I didn't do it. We got the letter to Sakharov, but I didn't deliver it. One of my officers did. The next day, I'm summoned down to the Foreign Office for a meeting with Kornienko, who was then acting foreign minister, and a real no-goodnik. And Kornienko said, I want a private word with you. And so we had a private word. He said, let me tell you something. If you deal with Dr. Sakharov, you don't deal with us. I said, let me tell you something, Mr. Kornienko. Don't you tell me how to run my mission. He said, I think we understand each other. So I did not see Sakharov until the day before I left Moscow, finally. I spent 4 hours with him. A marvelous human being. But the point is, you get people in Washington doing these silly things and refusing the advice of the American ambassador. And when that sort of thing happens, ultimately, I think you have to come to the conclusion that your services are no longer useful or needed. So I quit.
I'm sure this has been one of the most enlightening discussions we've had. A diplomat is a man sent abroad to lie and deceive in the interests of his country. Somebody said...
The other definition is that a diplomat is somebody who will tell you to go to hell, and you'll enjoy it.
Well, that was the phrase. That was the same thing I was going to say. Ambassador Toon has indicated there's another way to be a diplomat, and we're all most grateful for this discussion. Thank you very much.